Welcome to the fourth episode of the Blazers Edge podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lucia. This week, we're going to get straight into it because I talked to Blazers Edge contributor Dane Carbaugh. As always, if you have any feedback, go ahead and send that to bedgecast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. All right, Dane, it's good to chat with you today. Would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I am a video contributor for Blazers Edge. I do the breakdowns on that site. I have my own Blazers site. It's called theyoungsabonis.com. Most of that is just other kind of breakdown stuff for upcoming games we have for the Blazers. And then I'm also a news desk contributor for SBNation.com. And that's basically, you know, covering games, doing analysis, writing about trades, doing all that kind of stuff. So
I've noticed that on your videos for Blazers Edge and in your articles for Young Sabonis, a lot of times you'll break things down and you'll talk about things at a technical level and go over a lot of X's and O's stuff, so to speak. Where do you get your basketball acumen?
Sure. You know, I've been playing basketball, obviously, my whole life. But part of that is also that I'm a son of a coach. So I have that background as well. I mean, my dad was a guy who didn't just coach the local team. He, you know, got out his books and, you know, rented books or bought books to make sure that he was better. And I was, as part of that, and as, you know, I played point guard, so I was sort of needing to understand what was going on both ends of the floor. And I think I was a good two-way player, I think. So that's why I have interest in both ends of the game. It's not just one thing or the other. But a lot of that is also studying, you know, finding books of my own and making sure you're reading everything online. So,
well, that's cool, man. I think that it's been a really good contribution to Blazers Edge this year to have kind of those breakdowns so that some of us fans who just kind of watch the games, who don't really know exactly basketball at that level, it's nice to see someone be able to break it down and put it in a format where we can see that and be like, oh, okay, Damian Lillard is going under screens and therefore it's easier for opponents to get three-pointers off against him or whatever the case may be. So it's really awesome to have that, and it's been an awesome addition to Blazers Edge this year for sure.
Thanks. Yeah, you know, I have two goals with it. The first one is what you're talking about, where, you know, hopefully people have a little better idea about what's going on and maybe they don't, say, jump to conclusions about, you know, what's happening with the team. Mm-hmm. And the other part of that is that I'd like to people to say, you know, watch a play that I broke down on offense and be able to, this screen is coming here, so they can tell their friend, oh, hey, you know, this screen's going to happen over there in the corner, and then this guy's going to shoot, and then it happens, and they're, you know, oh, wow, that's pretty cool. So that's sort of my two goals.
Yeah, that's cool, man. And it's definitely been great for the website. With all the introduction said, let's go ahead and talk some Blazers. Did you watch any of the NBA All-Star events this weekend?
Yeah, I got to watch the first 2 days. I didn't see much of the All-Star game, but I saw all the skills competitions and the Rising Stars Challenge, all that good stuff.
You see the celebrity game?
Yeah, that was interesting at best.
At best, man, right?
Yeah, I mean, Duncan tore it up, man. So he's got to get a 10-day contract somewhere, right?
Yeah, Kevin Hart with the MVP.
Yeah, I didn't understand that. He was terrible.
Well, Justin Bieber got it a couple years ago. I mean, that is what it's going to be. It's the fans for sure. Yeah. Kobe Bryant starting in the All-Star game. But let's not break down the celebrity game too far. Let's talk about some of the events that Damian Lillard was in. Personally, I don't think you can take much from the Rising Stars Challenge. No, defense really isn't priority number one, two, or three there. So really, I don't think you can take much from that other than, you know, hey, maybe Damian Lillard is up there with these young guys. He's probably one of the better young guys, if not top two or three, I would say, for sure. But we already knew that going into the game. Let's talk about maybe some of the Saturday night events that he was in. What did you think about the skills contest?
Trey Burke obviously saved him there at the end, but I think he did a good job. I mean, a lot of guys seem to be sort of, not dogging it isn't the right word, but not really, you know, running through the the slalom, things like that. And he and Trey Burke really seemed to get along together. You saw that with the videos after it and everything. So I think that really helped.
I thought it was cool that he actually came out and gave it a decent effort, him and Burke.
Yeah.
It's kind of a silly competition, but to be completely honest, like watching a guy out there with the Portland jersey on going through it and winning it, I'm not gonna lie, it was a little bit of pride going on there, saying, oh, representing the city, representing the state of Oregon, representing basketball up here, because we don't get the best exposure in the world. So I thought that was kind of cool that he came out and took it seriously and actually went for the win on that. What'd you think about the 3-point contest? They're really He was only in it for one round, but what'd you expect going into that?
I mean, he looked like he was a little bit nervous as far as having, he's definitely cold-blooded when it comes to in-game situations. But there's 9 other guys on the court with him at that time, or in the competition, he has an idea of what he has to beat, things like that. So in a 3-point contest, you really have lots more doubt. How much do I really need to make? You have a whole stadium looking directly at you and nobody else. And it could have been cold coming off the bench. I mean, lots of times you have to wait to get in rhythm in games, things like that. Things we've all experienced as players. So he was okay. Obviously, that was one of the ones I predicted him to win, just because he does have such a his stroke is so consistent, is what it is. It's not necessarily classic. He has some sway in his shot. He brings the ball up in front of him, sort of strays, things like that. But he does do a good job, obviously. He has incredible range, like nobody I've ever seen play in Portland before.
If it was from 30 feet, I think he would have won that for sure.
He definitely, him and Steph could have just shot from half court, and I would have been happy, So, but he did an okay job. You're right. It's great to see having somebody have a Portland jersey and all those things. People were worried about him getting tired or something, which is, I
No,
mean,
well, that's silly. He's 23 years old. He's a
he's
professional athlete. He's
come
out.
on.
He's going to be out partying every night at All-Star Weekend anyway. That's what I would be worried about, getting tired, not pulling off the warm-ups for 5 minutes of jump shooting.
Yeah, well, people were, yeah, exactly. I mean, I was in the gym today for an hour, shooting jump shots. I didn't get tired. He was there for, yeah, he's there for 5 minutes. And it's literally his job. I don't think he's worried about it.
No.
People were putting up on Twitter, I don't see how it's such a big, the one that threw me off was that they said, I don't see how it's such a big deal that he's doing five events. He's gonna, that's not really that big a physical challenge, which is the other side of that coin. And of course, the answer is it's that you're in five events representing, your team, representing, being able to show that you have, I mean, the events are all for different skills. And so you have one player that has all of those different skills. That's an incredible thing for the city of Portland.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely a point of pride for us watching, as we mentioned earlier. And it was pretty cool to see a dude from a small market get that kind of exposure and opportunity from the NBA. I'm not sure if maybe that was kind of by design or what, but all power to him for taking the opportunity, because there's no reason why he shouldn't do it, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree.
So I guess we could talk about the dunk contest. Obviously, that was a bit of a disaster. If you're
Robbery.
a vintage fan, if you're a fan of vintage dunk contests, going back probably 2000 and prior, that was probably disappointing for you. So needless to say, there should be some changes. Well, what would you suggest going forward, to where they can make it more engaging for fans, but also entertaining and not blatantly confusing? That was kind of weird to me.
I mean, there's two parts of it I think were kind of confusing. For Portland fans, I think they were pretty disappointed because Damian Lillard definitely had one of, the best two dunks in the contest,
Yes.
and he didn't advance.
Was that the
I mean,
reverse East Bay, the
yes,
first one?
yeah, exactly. And I just don't understand how. I mean, the talk coming up to it is that, and this has been sort of a knock against him since, he came into the league, is that, he's not athletic enough, which I don't really understand.
That's silly.
To be honest,
It's a
because
small school thing, I bet.
it just doesn't make any sense. Because I mean, even if you see pictures of him up close, it's not like he's not undefined or he's not chubby. I mean, so I don't so it's not a physical thing. His play isn't he's not say his driving game off the dribble. It's not Brandon Roy slow.
He's
It's
not
not
Andre Miller out there.
it's not that kind of pace. I mean, it's a quick pace. He beats guys with his first and second step. I mean, he gets around them. So I'm not really sure what that's about. And on defense, of course, he's just not that well practiced. So, and saying, that goes hand in hand with saying that, oh, he's only had eight dunks all year. It's like, what does that have to do with anything? Like, why would the point guard need to dunk all the time? How would the point guard dunk all the time? I mean, that doesn't make really that much sense just because he's, but obviously he got up the most. I mean, the slow motion, the phantom cams of him going up are insane. Or there's some really great photos of him doing that dunk, especially when he's just passing it between his legs and he's, split out wide. It's crazy. I mean, So he did a great job. That's a little disappointing, I think, for Portland fans. He didn't go further. I think the other half of that would be, we watched it somewhere where we didn't have the sound on the TV. We were in a public place. We didn't know who won. We didn't understand it,
Neither did the
Like, we understand the
announcers.
rules, but there's no announcers, and there's no chyrons to tell you what's going on. So you're like, I didn't know that John Wall was the winner until I checked on Twitter the next morning.
Well, they
Or
were
what the
all.
best dunker, like.
Everyone was confused. The announcers were confused. The judges were confused. It seemed like no one really knew exactly what was going on, and the whole thing was just kind of silly. But I don't. Why can't we just take eight dudes, the way they did, what, 2000 and prior, I think, and just do three rounds, just narrow it down.
I mean, that's the other thing is that, the dunk contest was too short. I mean, we watched the skills contest for far longer than the dunk contest. I mean, the 3-point contest went to an extra round, so it was even longer. The dunk contest was like, we had that round get over, and everybody there was saying, oh, okay, like ready for the next round. And then all of a sudden it was commercials over and, like sweeping views of the city and, back into the commercial. It's like, what
John
was
Wall's
this?
getting presented dunker of the
Yeah.
night in quotation marks, like as voted on by Twitter fans or so. Yeah, clearly the dunk contest could use a lot of work, where I think that Damian Lillard did a great job. I think that most of the Portland fans can be proud of the performance that he put in, and just I think everyone kind of understands that the whole thing is kind of screwy and that hopefully they'll improve it in the future. Did you happen to catch the All-Star game or?
I caught a little bit of it here and there, and I read recaps and stuff, and I saw what went on. I saw the unfortunate issues that Scott Brooks had with the Portland players,
Oh,
apparently,
jeez.
and that Mike Rice and Tony tried to call him out on Twitter.
Yeah, I saw that. It's like you got 12 of the best guys, and you got a first-time All-Star, and you got a low-key guy like LaMarcus Aldridge. So Damian Lillard, by virtue of seniority, is probably gonna not get very many minutes. That's just kind of how it goes. LaMarcus Aldridge, with his style of play, it's not really conducive to the All-Star game. So I don't know what Portland fans expect for them both to play 25 minutes and get 20 shots apiece. Like, there's guys out there like Blake Griffin and Kevin Durant who are gonna get their shots no matter what and their minutes. So I think it's kind of much ado about nothing to worry about the amount of minutes they get in the All-Star game, because I don't think it's the actual performance in the All-Star game that matters. It's more the accolades just from being an All-Star. Now, LA is a three-time All-Star. Damian is an All-Star in his second season, and he competed in all five events. That's the kind of thing in the future that I think is going to help maybe draw a free agent or two, or maybe if there's a guy with a trade kicker clause in his contract where he says, okay, that's cool, or the no trade clause, the veto clause. And you say, yeah, I'll go to Portland. They got two legitimate all-stars. So I think it's more the accolades of being an all-star and the fact that you can mention that in the future, as opposed to the actual game and how they do in it. I mean, no one really watches that game and takes much from it. Do you remember the MVP from last year?
No, I mean it doesn't, you're right, it doesn't make any sense, because if you're gonna have the same fan in one breath criticizes not having Blazer players play, and in the next breath criticizes the fact that nobody plays defense and the game doesn't really matter. It's like,
Exactly.
well, pick a side.
I mean, yeah. I don't know. It's not really that big of a deal. I'm just glad that they were there and that Damian had so many opportunities to represent Portland. I thought that was really cool. And they obviously get to do the media rounds while they're there, and so that never hurts, getting your name out there and getting the Portland Trail Blazers name out there as much as possible.
Yeah, I think it definitely works too. I mean, LaMarcus deserves it. He's having one of the best, I mean, the best seasons as a Trailblazer ever. You know, he's definitely one of the top players in the NBA. Damian really has that chip on his shoulder, needed to prove to everybody last year that he's the man, and did so by bringing home the Rookie of the Year trophy. And, you know, getting to the All-Star game, I think, sort of just pushes him and is probably validating him, you know, for what he's doing. He's not going to show it, but I really like that for him. I think that he's the kind of player that he makes sense for Portland in a lot of different ways, not just on the court. So him getting to the All-Star game, I think, is a big deal for the city of Portland. Yeah, I like it a lot.
So the next step in that ascension then for Damian Lillard and the Blazers would be playoffs and then making some noise in the playoffs. So let's talk a little bit about the team here, because what we've noticed the last last dozen or so games, 15 games, the offense has been a little bit down. Has there anything that you've noticed from a technical standpoint that you can kind of point out and say, this is where the Blazers are struggling a little bit, this is where they could improve, or this is how opposing defenses are countering the Blazers, and how can they counteract what the defenses are doing against them?
Sure, you know, my last breakdown for Blazers Edge was all about that. It was about the fact that teams are trying to overplay, particularly at the elbow extended. They're really overplaying that passing lane. So those swings to the corner, those cross court, you know, where a Blazer player is above the break on the arc and throws it to the far corner. You know, they're overplaying that pass like crazy. You know, there's enough tape on the Blazers offense now to figure that out. The other part of that is, you know, they were really tired going into that 3 or 4 day break they had, where I'm sure everybody saw pictures of them, you know, hanging out in Benihana's during their break. You know, had a little team time together.
Sure.
But they needed that break. You know, they really did, because they were, you know, an NBA season is long and tough, and even for guys who are very in shape, and you know, and expect to do this for a long time, they need a break. Or, you know, it's not just physical fatigue; it's mental fatigue as well, which I think really shows you in the fact that, you know, I was looking at their shots the other day, and you know, a lot of their three pointers, and you know, their big problem with their 3 point shooting lately is, when they do get open shots, they're clanging them, which
Yeah,
is
what?
doesn't help if teams are, you know, overplaying your threes and you're not getting that many attempts, or your attempts are more contested in general. And if you add that with the fact that you're missing wide open attempts due to fatigue, obviously you're going to have where they end up, you know, the last 2 weeks or so, which is, you know, their offense is really going to suffer.
So you think a big reason why the Blazers' offense was struggling was not only because opposing defenses have enough game tape to really kind of change the defense that they're playing against the Blazers to maybe counteract some of their moves, but that the Blazers were just kind of tired in general. They didn't have really the legs for their open shots that they were getting.
Yeah, you know, I think that's part of what an NBA season is. I mean, 82 games is, I mean, that's a long time to play. I mean, that's why people, I mean, plus, you know, players are playing with nagging injuries that aren't really reported on. You know, if you tweak your ankle and it's not bad enough to, if you're just going to wrap it up tighter,
Unless you're
that's not an
Batum,
injury. Unless you're Batum, yeah,
then every little nick and
but
injury gets reported.
you're not telling the PR department about that. You
Right.
know, like, but you're playing with a heavily wrapped ankle. I mean, things like that just sort of add up, and you know, and that's going to be the real test moving into March, because in March they don't have more than a day's rest between any one game,
Well, yeah,
and it's going to be wild.
they had Joel Freeland go out with that bummer of an
Yeah.
injury, obviously, that's going to keep him out up to 2 months. So,
If I would have told you in December of 2012 that the next season, your playoff standing, your home court playoff standing, may have relied on Joel Freeland, how crazy would you thought I would be?
I would have taken a look at the roster and I would have said, yeah, that probably makes sense. But considering the lack of depth, but I would have been taken aback, because if we're talking about 14 months ago, how he was playing. He wasn't playing, as I recall, maybe 3, 4 minutes a game tops. Yeah, I would have been absolutely blown away if you told me that Myers Leonard was a really important member of the Blazers' rotation and that his injury was all kinds of concern and prompting a lot of trade proposals, actually, from fans and stuff. As crazy as that sounds.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, with CJ really coming out of the woodwork, you know, I think that's the other thing is, you know, I didn't necessarily write about it, but a lot of people did, and I think we all kind of shared that same sentiment that, you know, especially with how well they were doing in the first 20 games of the year, 25 games this year, when CJ was out, you know, oh, is he going to be an impact, or are the Blazers really going to need him this year? And the answer from everybody was no. But now, as we've gone on and we've seen teams really hammer down on their offense, and they really do need that, that bench wing penetrator. They really do need that because they're so predictable. Which, to be honest, for me, that's a big reason why I think people are too hard on Mo Williams, is because makes a lot of dumb decisions and a lot of dumb shots. That's because who is he working with? Who on offense is making moves, can make cuts, can create off the ball, can come off a screen hard enough to make separation from somebody? I mean, Darrell Wright got benched. He literally can't do that. That's why he got benched. So, lots of Mo's shots come because he has to be the only creator on offense lots of times. When Dame's not in the game with them, their lineup's according to 82 games with Mo in there and Dame not playing off ball are atrocious. Like,
Well, when Mo's in this, if he's playing with, three or more second unit players, which I wouldn't want to see that too often, five bench players. But if he's playing with several bench players, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, who's going to be the next option on offense? It's not going to be a healthy Joel Freeland. It's not. So yeah, I could see how if he's playing with several other bench unit players, and yeah, he needs to be a part of the offense, but. Sometimes when he's playing with the ball and Damian's playing off the ball and he's playing with several of the starters, I think that's when maybe he can take more of a secondary scoring role and that's when he can roll off a few of the shot attempts, I think, a little bit and kind of be a bit more of a distributor because he's demonstrated the fact, not only this year but over his career, that he can be a distributing point guard. I mean, he is certainly a scorer, but he's capable of passing and his penetration. That allows for a lot of kickouts. And so if he were more, I don't know, I think he's kind of got that defined role as a wing scorer off the bench, so that's what you're gonna get with him. And it's probably not fair to ask him to adjust the way he plays depending on who he's playing with.
No. I don't think he's going to change how he plays. I mean,
Yeah, at
he's
this
what, in
point in his
his ninth or
career.
10th year or something. It doesn't really make sense. The strange thing about Mo is he does have that ability. He doesn't often show it, or I'd say the majority of the time he doesn't show it because of who he's in the game with. But unfortunately, an interesting thing for the Blazers offense, especially their bench rotation, is that he's one of the best spot-up shooters on the team. I mean, his spot where he should be playing is the two. Not necessarily defensively, but the Blazers' second unit defense at this point in time, who cares? I mean, who are they going to stop? I mean, but in any case, that's his best spot on offense, is as playing that two guard, playing getting all of those Wesley Matthews passes. That's the best spot for
So
him.
you mean off the ball?
Yeah, off the ball would be the best spot for him because, that's really where he's really efficient as a shooter. And the problem with that, though, is that CJ McCollum really isn't ready to step into that role as a distributor yet at the point guard position. So,
Yeah, because there's no one to play backup point when Mo is on the floor as the two guard and when Dame's on the bench. So he kind of naturally has to shift over to the main ball handler and thus you see a lot of dribbling and a lot of pass or a lot of shot attempts there. Not as many passes. Mo Williams missed a couple games there, and that's kind of when I think CJ really came out of his shell and stepped up quite a bit and showed what he could do off the bench for the Blazers. Do you see any kind of a potential log jam with the backcourt scoring with CJ McCollum really stepping up in his absence?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that's going to give Mo Williams more options. The thing about CJ is that, he's really, with Mo out, he's become the creator, which is great because, the Blazers need an isolation creator, or somebody who can at least not necessarily work the pick and roll, but can score off the pick and roll himself, which is excellent to have. But the other part of that is CJ has, incredible range. He's a great 3-point shooter, which that's sort of something that, maybe it's his 4 year thing being in college, who knows what that is, but he really is a other than defense, he's a pretty good player on offense. So with Mo, he has somebody else to kick to that's going to be reliable, somebody that, when Wes isn't in the game or Dame isn't in the game, somebody he didn't have. Darrell Wright really, I think, struggled early in the year when he was part of the main rotation, and CJ's really going to take those minutes and utilize them well, I think. So I don't see a logjam there at all.
So when they're in the game together in the second unit, do you see Mo Williams being the main ball handler and then McCollum playing more off the ball, or would you see it the other way around? How do you think that would work?
I think that if you're going to pick to define them by what position they're technically playing in, so which is something that 82 Games has to do, that Basketball Reference has to do, Mo Williams is going to be the point guard. The thing about that is that that's not always the case. Lots of sets in the NBA start with the off guard technically having the ball to start the play, and that means bringing up the ball up the court, right? So they're still in the scoring role. They're still in a gonna come off a screen for a shot, and the point guard is still going to be the person who's going to be facilitating all the passing, but that person may be off the ball. So anybody who's played a good example would be anybody who's played 2K, I'm sure, has had that same thing happen to them. If they've tried to run a play in NBA 2K, that's exactly what that is. So I think Mo Williams is going to handle the ball though. CJ isn't necessarily he doesn't see the court the same way that Mo does because Mo's been in the league much longer than him. He's played with lots of different players. He has a better feel for this team. I mean, he's been CJ's been practicing with the team, but Mo's been practicing and has game experience and is logging more than 20 minutes a game for the last 42 games or whatever. So or longer. So, but yeah, I think that Mo is going to end up being the point guard. It's unfortunate because I think Mo is a very good an off a good, very good off ball guard. But for the time being, for the season, that's what it's going to be.
So you see McCollum maybe taking on more of a catch and shoot role, or off the pass instead of off the dribble, kind of off the bench.
Yeah, I don't think that he's good enough at what we're going to do is we're going to find out if he's good enough at playing that side pick and roll, because lots of the Blazers sets end up with that guy in the corner, and then a post coming over or out or up to set a pick to start the secondary action of the play. So if we see that he's good enough at running the pick and roll, that may be great. But to be honest, he's gonna mostly be in those sets where he gets that Wes Matthews flare screen or the slip screen or things like that. He's mostly gonna get those kind of plays, I think, to start.
So who do you think on the defensive end, how do you mask the deficiencies of Williams or McCollum as a rookie?
That's pretty difficult. I mean, there's two things going on with the Blazers defense, if we really want to sort of dive into that pile right now.
Oh yeah, you bet.
That's it's hard because there's two things going on, is that none of the Blazers wing defenders, that includes Batum and Wes Matthews, are elite wing defenders. Wes and Nick are very good.
I think a lot of
They're
us
not
fans
elite.
like to think of Matthews and Batum as kind of elite level defenders. I think that's kind of a thing that goes around Blazers communities where people talk about it as Matthews and Batum being these really great defenders. And so what you're saying is that they're not quite as elite as we might think they are.
No, I think there's two parts of that. Let's focus on the group as a whole, and then we'll whittle it down to those two guys. But
Certainly.
as far as the Mo Williams and CJ McCollum thing goes, the Blazers' defensive strategy from the coaching staff is, and you can watch and see them do this, is they shade one side of the ball handler. It could be their strong hand, even if they're not dribbling with it, or it could be the side that the pick is coming to. But they shade the ball handler very, very hard. So that means they're up on one side. And what that does is it puts them out of position a lot of times. So the problem with that is if you couple that with the fact that, say, Mo Williams, CJ McCollum, and Damian Lillard aren't very good on-ball defenders in the first place, and they're out of position because of how the coaching staff is having them play on the ball, that's going to make for a lot of issues on defense. So I don't necessarily think that's Mo Williams gambles. So that's
Right.
definitely there. CJ McCollum, we don't know yet. I've seen him basically forget to do what the coaching staff is telling him and basically play with his hips square and play very good, on ball in, say, isolation situations. So who knows? I don't how you mask that, I'm not sure. I mean, that's going to be the problem for the Blazers for the rest of the season. It's going to be the problem for them going into the playoffs, is how does their defense perform? So
Right.
I said before that I think that the Blazers go as far as Damian Lillard and Mo Williams take them on the defensive end of the floor, because their offense, even though they've maybe had some struggles of the last 15 games or so. That's not the problem with the Blazers, obviously. They're still the number one offense in the league. That's not going to be the problem. They're going to figure it out. It's the defensive strategy. I mean, it's people have written about this before, but their strategy is so vanilla that is it going to work with people who are not necessarily good wing defenders? I don't know. So, and the problem starts with who are the point guards you're going to face in the West in the playoffs? Chris Paul, Tony Parker, Russell Westbrook. So that's a hard night-to-night matchup over across, across 7 games, where you have some of the best basketball minds in the world focusing on just your team for a week and a half. That's very difficult.
When the perimeter defenders are struggling, what does that do to, say, LaMarcus Aldridge, Robin Lopez, Thomas Robinson, a healthy Freeland when he's in there? What does that do for the front court players? How do they have to make up for the perimeter defense of the Blazers?
They're a victim of this of the strategy as well, because lots of times they don't play. So in the case of the starters, LaMarcus and Robin Lopez, they're not necessarily playing in the spot that they should be playing a lot of the times. When you have above the arc pick and roll situations, they're still standing at the free throw line. They're still and the idea is to seed that mid-range jumper, right? But the problem is there's a difference between allowing the mid-range jumper and forcing the mid-range jumper. And what the Blazers do right now is they allow the mid-range jumper.
So what specifically would be the difference there? What in terms of execution, what would the team do differently to force that as opposed to just allowing it?
Sure. So I think, if you're looking at a lot of teams, say Indiana or anybody else who runs that ice pick and roll defense, which is the Blazers run exclusively on the pick, they don't hedge with LaMarcus the way that, say, Indiana does with Luis Scola or David West. They ice specifically, which means they are staying below the pick, and they are hoping that the ball handler defender works over the top of the pick, and they basically deny entry to the lane.
Does
You know
that
what they need
make
to
for
do.
some awkward switches sometimes?
Well, that's what happens when players try to snake the pick, which is when they go across the strong side of the pick, and then they snake back to the right hand. Or we'll say if they're going. They snake back to the opposite side of the pick. What that does is try to force the switch from the big man onto the ball handler, and as the screener rolls and sort of takes on the smaller defender. So, but I think what that really does is, the strategy the Blazers have puts Robin Lopez and LaMarcus Aldridge at a disadvantage. I mean, they're standing at the free throw line on a pick above the arc, which either most players and what we're seeing other teams do is they're taking that 16-foot jumper. And they're not taking it contested because if you're standing at the free throw line and you're having to jump out, even if you're 7'1", you're not really putting pressure on that person. And the other thing it does is if they're that far back, it also allows smaller guys like Ty Lawson or Chris Paul or somebody else who's crafty off the dribble to, I mean, they have from the arc where the screen is set all the way to the bucket to pick up enough speed to get past Robin Lopez. I mean, what do you think is going to happen?
A
I mean,
foul?
a foul, or lots of times we'll see. I mean, Robin Lopez isn't as clunky as people think he is, but he's also he's not as quick as somebody who's his same size. Roy Hibbert, if we're talking about proportional clunkiness, Roy Hibbert is less clunky than Robin Lopez is. He's more athletic, I would say. More, he's quicker off his he's quicker feet, on defense at least. So. What that really forces is, those guys can go right around them. They built up ahead of steam. They get two or three, bounces off the dribble above the arc, coming to the free throw line. They're just going to go around them, which is exactly what happens. They get frozen, and then you end up relying on the helper's helper, which would be LaMarcus in that case to try to contest the shot. So I think what they really need to do is, on those pick and rolls, which teams really put the Blazers in a lot. They put Damian Lillard into that pick and roll situation above the arc a lot. He's not on the arc, he's above it. And what that does is when the Blazers aren't sucking up, and I'm working on this for a breakdown this week, to be honest, but you'll look at tape and Roy Hibbert will be an arm's length away from the pick, which is his man on the defense. The Blazers are, 2 arm's lengths away. That he couldn't reach out and grab him and actually touch his guy. That's how far back he is. They need to step up. I mean, I think they need to change it and put the onus on, because what that does is it will force them to take that. If they decide to take that same shot, they'll be in a better position to contest it, right? Because they'll be right there. Or if they try to go around them, they can see they're trying to turn. They can turn their hips. The big man can turn his hips and run along with him. And then the help defender has that puts him in a situation where the offender has to both work around a gigantic guy behind him reaching over the top of him trying to, block his shot, and a help defender coming across the middle of the lane, the helper's helper, to contest his shot. So he has two guys on him, so he's not just bowling right by him. Because what that really does is if you're another step closer to that pick, he can't take those two or three dribbles to get that head of steam up to run down the lane line. It really does force, even if it's a little bit, it really does force him from, picking up that incredible speed that those guys can get. So it's a big problem.
If they were playing more up, would they be more inclined to pick up fouls if they were playing a bit more aggressively, the
They
front
pick
court
up fouls
players?
now, don't they?
Well,
I mean,
certainly, but they're not fouling out.
no, I don't think so. I mean, that situation, that's more of about coaching than anything else. How to be able to contest shots properly. I mean, they have a great coaching staff there that would be able to, fix and do that. I mean, Indiana, I don't have their stats up in front of me right now, but their Roy Hibbert isn't fouling out of games. David West isn't fouling out of games. I mean, left and right. And to be honest, I don't think that LaMarcus Aldridge is any less fleet of foot, or certainly he has the same kind of basketball IQ as David West. I mean, they're Robin Lopez and LaMarcus Aldridge are both basketball players in every sense of the word, and they would be able to figure out how to work that coverage properly. Even if it comes down to their, a quarter step. If Lopez is a quarter step slower than Roy Hibbert, he's going to be able to still avoid foul trouble and contest the shot, which is what you really want.
So at this point, you think it's more systemic than individual effort?
I would say it's 50-50. I think the system is not good for the players on the wing, because the problem is that if you're running the ice, you're really hoping that the wing defender needs to recover. And the problem with the Blazers is the wing defender doesn't always recover. Damian Lillard has, and I didn't watch him in college, but he really does have bad instincts on the pick. He's a lot of times he's not looking for it. So when that near side leg comes out, he's getting caught up on it. And you'll see him get caught up on the hips of big guys. And then when they roll towards him, the direction that the pick is going, then he's caught up on their butt. He's caught up on their back. Then he's caught up on their other hip, trying to get around their other hip. So he has to go around a whole gigantic 7-foot guy in order to just, he has to get around his whole body width-wise, not just, lengthwise or whatever. So I think that the problem is that, and a lot of times there's too much game film that I watch where Damian Lillard is, he gets around the pick, and then he thinks the guy is too far in front of him, and then he slows up. I see his shoulders, rise up back to, up to where he's in upright position. He needs to be continuing to help out the guy. He ends up ceding that position to the offensive player and letting Robin Lopez and LaMarcus Aldridge take him one-on-one, which doesn't help.
I think I've noticed that some people have kind of figured that the Blazers, some of the woes on defense are due to the fact that they're saving their energy for offense. What do you think about kind of a response like that? Maybe Damian Lillard isn't playing as intense as we think he could play because he's saving himself for the offensive end. Do you think there's any merit to that?
I don't think so, because I don't think that's the kind of player that Damian Lillard is. I think that he's somebody who wants to, beat his opponent in every aspect of the game. I think that, it's he has the same sort of position, or same sort of problem with his position that is very indicative of, say, what Myers Leonard is going through. So for Dame, he has this learning curve because, the best position in the NBA is the point guard position. There's almost too many of them. It's really has become, with all the rule changes in the last 15 years, it's become a point guard league. So asking him to, even with 4 years, at university, he's having to guard some of the best players in the NBA every single night on a consistent basis. So that's a really hard thing to do. And I think that's the same thing with Myers Leonard. So Myers Leonard's only been playing in the post since he was, 16 years old. So to ask him to play at an NBA level, when he was 20 is insane. I mean, he's been playing it for 4 years when he was a rookie, you know? So it's like, you know, anything you can, the NBA is not an easy business. Otherwise, you know, they wouldn't get paid so much. So to ask him to do that at that level and get paid that much money and do it at, you know, so well, it's not an easy thing to do. So people need to be, you know, sort of patient with that. And I think it's going to be the same thing with Damian, is that, you know, his defense is, he definitely tries. He just doesn't have the timing down yet. He doesn't have the natural instinct, I don't think, for it yet. But that's all things that people learn. I mean, people can, you know, people can get a 3-point shot. We've seen DeMar DeRozan, you know, come in as a high athletic, low skilled player and, you know, create a shot and become an all-star this year in Toronto. You know, we've seen Michael Conley figure out how to shoot the ball, you
Right.
know,
Yeah.
over the course of, you know, 5 seasons or something. You know, people round out their games. So I think Damian Lillard will get better at that.
All things considered, between Leonard and Lillard, who do you think has more potential to turn the corner on the defensive end? Or do you think they both do, or do you think neither of them do?
I think it's probably going to have to be Damian Lillard, mostly because I think that, you know, Lillard's seeing a higher level of competition every night. He's a starter. He plays against those guys for too many minutes every night, you know, 37 minutes a night or something, 36 minutes a night. So he's seeing the floor more often. He's seeing the floor against better competition. He's a star player of the team. He's an all-star. I mean, he has more coaching on him. He does. That's just how it works. I mean, there's not enough coaching to go around in the NBA, to be honest, even with Kim Hughes working with Myers Leonard. Myers Leonard is an offensive prospect. That's what he is. People don't realize that. I mean, he has relatively short arms. He's highly athletic. You know, to be honest, his ceiling is going to be something like if Tyson Chandler had the ability to shoot a jumper but couldn't really D up somebody as well as Tyson Chandler does. That's going to be his game. He's going to be he can rebound the ball just fine. Like, to be honest, you know, he didn't know how to box out when he got benched, you know, through the preseason. If you watch him off ball, he's doing exactly what Robin Lopez does, which is he boxes out for other guys. He may doesn't necessarily get, you know, all the rebounds himself. Of course, his per 36 numbers are pretty good in rebounding. So, you know, he's doing a good job. He's coming along the way that I would expect an NBA prospect, center position, to do. But as far as who's going to be the better defender or who has a better, you know, if I have to pick between one or two, it's going to be Damian Lillard, you know. And he's the kind of guy who doesn't rest in that kind of thing, you know. His motivation may be better than anybody on that team, you know, even Wesley Matthews. So
Yeah, I don't think we could question the work ethic on that. It's just, I guess, a matter of having the physical tools combined with the basketball IQ, and then you combine that with the dedication to it. And so, yeah, I guess if you think about it, Damian Lillard probably is about as close to that whole package as you could expect from a guy his age and coming from the competition that he played against.
I don't think that's a knock on Myers Leonard either. I mean, if you look at Tyson Chandler, you know, Tyson Chandler is going to do what? He's going to run off the pick and roll with Chris Paul for most of his career and throw down dunks that you're incredible. You know, he's going to block somebody. He's going to win championships for the Mavericks basically by, you know, like by virtue of just adding him to the roster, things like that. But he's not necessarily a loss on offense, but you know, given the ball at the free throw line, and he looks like Robin. You know, he has some sort of touch, but he doesn't have a reliable touch that you're like, oh, give him the ball at you know, at the free throw line and let him shoot. You know, which one is better at that position? That's sort of where the question, what you're asking. But you know, Myers has an ugly shot, but he has touch out to the 3-point line. How many guys? I mean, he's a legitimate 7-1, you know, center.
He's
How many
huge.
guys of that size can literally shoot the ball from that thing? I mean, you know, he jacked him up all summer league, which was hilarious. I loved it. I need to have him see another 3-pointer. If he doesn't make a 3-pointer this season, I'll be really disappointed. But you know, that's not a knock on Myers, I don't think, as far as, you know, whether he's not going to be as good on defense. I think it's just his the bulk of where he's going to provide value is going to be on offense.
Would you say that his range on offense is akin to a young Sabonis?
Yeah, probably. Except he doesn't shoot set shots, right? Like he can't pass the ball as well. But I wish he's wearing the right number for it, right?
Like to see the behind the back pass. That was classic.
Hey, you know, Arne Duncan did do a behind the back pass, or it was behind the shoulder head pass in
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. It
The
was very
celebrity game.
Sabonis-like. Yep, it was very Sabonis-like.
Didn't expect to see those kind of moves from the Secretary of Education, but
Yeah.
yeah, not bad out there.
I would like to say that, the strange thing, I think, and I don't know why we're talking about Myers Leonard so much, but we're going to.
Hey, why
So,
not?
but the strange thing about him is that people get on him, right? P fans need to choose somebody to hate on their own team. Nolan Smith, last year was it, but he was legitimately
I would
terrible. And
say he might. Come on. He
he played a
wasn't.
legitimate,
He was
he played too
terrible.
many minutes last year, so it made sense. I mean, no, he was terrible.
There's. I mean, I don't want to
You
bag on
can't
the
turn the
guy,
ball
but.
over. You can't turn the ball over that many times against third stringers. Sorry,
Exactly.
Nolan. You just can't.
But about Leonard.
But what do you need him for? I mean, they may need him now because simply because Thomas Robinson isn't ready to fill that spot, right? And
Exactly.
because Joel Freeland is injured. But if you had Joel Freeland, most teams have, a Joel Freeland and then somebody, a slightly better version of, so like the Thunder have, Perk, right, as their starter by default, unfortunately. And then they have Steven Adams, and then they have Nick Collison, right? So they have guys that are sort of, they have varying talents and they bring in other things. But if one goes down, they still have the two other ones. The Blazers don't have that. But if they did have that, which is possible for them since they may be looking to have a trade before February 20th. Myers Leonard is not a, I mean, he sat on the bench for half the season. He's not a crucial part of the rotation. He doesn't need to be as good as people want him to be or, need him to be. It could be that his, his draft position is there, but to be honest, he's a long-term prospect that, it could be a lot worse. He could be, lots of guys in the top 15, flame out entirely. I mean, they're legitimately bad
Well,
in their
Anthony
first 3 years,
Bennett,
and they're,
number one pick.
I mean, they're legitimately bad in the first 3 years, and they're gone. Myers Leonard isn't going to be that. I mean, he's the, he's the biggest trade chip they have, because mostly because I don't think they're going to move CJ McCollum unless they get somebody huge in return.
The
But
biggest realistic trade chip, then.
he's the biggest realistic trade chip because
Yeah.
other general managers understand that he is a long-term project that could be, a unique talent. He could be, I don't know. To a team like New Orleans, who desperately needs Ryan Anderson shooting, he could be that in 3 years, where he's the big guy who can shoot who you can't really match up, or he could be Channing Frye, although I don't think he'll ever be as defensively as, profound as Channing Frye is. But he could be that guy. So I would just like to say right now, there's no reason to hate on the guy because he's sitting to the end of the bench, and there's no reason to hate on the guy. All you're gonna do is make him mad, and the Portland section of his book when he's 50 is not gonna be very fun if people don't stop ragging on him for being a prospect. The guy's 21.
All right, that's Dane coming through, getting Myers Leonard's back there. Myers Leonard's number one fan. Just
Hey, I
kidding.
came up with this nickname, all right? So,
For Leonard?
I did.
What is it?
Lemons?
Lemons, explain.
There's a lemons, there's a Meyer lemons. Like it's a kind of lemons.
Hey,
Yeah. It's real complex.
that works. I like it.
Yeah.
Have you tried pitching that on Twitter yet, or?
Oh no, it's been part of a Twitter for 2 years.
All right,
It's
good.
already like if you look at other basketball fans and you ever see somebody saying yada 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 lemon something, that's it. They're talking about Myers Leonard.
I gotta up my Twitter game
Yeah.
then, apparently.
You gotta have your Twitter game. Yeah.
Since we're talking about the young guys, I think we Allen Crabbe's probably not. He hasn't played enough to touch on. Kleber probably hasn't played enough. But you got Thomas Robinson there, who's playing some rotation minutes. Do you want to touch on him for a little bit and maybe talk a little bit about what you've seen from him this year?
Yeah, he's in the same boat as Myers as far as I think that he's really taken to coaching well, especially with it's looking more and more like that move that Terry Stotts did when he brought in Myers to replace Thomas a little bit, back there. That was just a mental thing.
Was that like
He
a
was,
motivation thing?
I think that was a motivation thing. He was trying to light a fire under him, I think, and it's worked. I mean, Thomas Robinson's been a top prospect his whole life. And I think that he's slowly grown that chip on his shoulder after being traded around his first year or the first 2 years or so. And he's not devoid of talent, obviously. I mean, he's going to be pretty good. He went to a top school, so he really seems to have taken his issues and focused on them and done a good job of that. I really like the fact that we don't see that. Before in the first 20 games or so, he'd get the ball at the corner, or sorry, the elbow, and he'd take two dribbles and do that drop step spin move travel thing. Yeah, okay, yeah. It's you're picturing in your head right now, fans at home, and it's terrible. How many times have you seen that? I mean, I've seen him do that move a couple times, but I haven't seen him travel on it. But before, it used to be, I mean, he was a black hole on offense. It was terrible. And he really does seem to have grasped the offense a lot better, which I really like. He seems to have increased his post game a little bit. He knows how to, push people to the baseline, when they're on one of the blocks, to make sure they get the hardest shot, not allow them to, fake to the baseline and, run to the lane, which is, very easy. He's done a very good job. I think I'm impressed with him. Is he ready to guard Nick Collison in the playoffs? I don't think so. That's n not yet. But we still have, almost half the season left to go. And there's lots to learn, and there's a great coaching staff behind him. So.
Yeah, I think that he's been. I think the best thing that I've seen from him personally, just watching him, and if you look at the stats, it kind of shows through, is his scrappiness on the boards. Especially if he's in there with the second unit and he's playing against other second unit guys. Thomas Robinson is going to clean up all the offensive glass.
He really does have a nose for the ball in a sense where, and we all play with players like this, or maybe you were a player like this. Some guys like Kevin Love has it all figured out. He knows how to box out for a rebound, and he has a nose for when he's out of position for a rebound, how to grab it away from somebody else. Thomas Robinson doesn't necessarily know how to box out yet, but he definitely has that instinct about, he understands the physics and the dynamics of how a ball comes off the rim and based on, where they are, or how high the person jumped, things like that. He has that all programmed into his brain, and it's great to see him, go for boards. If he can learn to box out a little better, he could be a really elite rebounder.
You think that he could be a solid rotation player by sometime next season?
Next season, absolutely. I really do. I mean, if something that goes into players' development is their summers. And how young players spend their summer is particularly interesting. So, I don't know how much of the summer, say, Myers Leonard spent with Kim Hughes. I know that he spent lots of time with Todd Forcier. So, there was lots of strength training in Myers Leonard's off season, things like that, right? So, who he works with this summer is going to be pretty important. Making sure that he knows where to be on the floor when, you'll see. Joel Freeland and Robin Lopez, they run to the right block when they run that screen for Batum to get the ball at the wing. He comes up and then he passes it down to Lamarcus in the left block. It's a really basic, play for his turnaround jumper or what have you, or that weird step back thing he's doing at the elbow. They run to the right block. They know that's where the ball is going to come off if there's a rebound, things like that. So he knows that, but how to position properly for that. That's more about skill and about, understanding how your particular opponent that night is moving. Who he works with this summer, I think is going to be pretty important. But I think he definitely has the talent, the natural skill. He certainly has the athleticism. I mean, goodness, to be able to, get on the board.
Okay, so you mentioned LaMarcus Aldridge a couple of minutes ago, and what I've noticed is that he kind of had this peak somewhere at the 35 to 45 game mark, I think, where he was getting to the line several more times a game than he had been throughout the course of the season. But lately, that's kind of fallen off, and now he's actually getting to the line less than a couple of other guys, like Damian Lillard, Wesley Matthews, and Robin Lopez, surprisingly enough. So what about LaMarcus's game? Have you seen evolve maybe from last season to this season and then from early season to now?
I mean, it's a good thing that Robin Lopez is such a good free throw shooter, but
Right?
it really is. I mean,
It's bailed
how many
us out
people
a
have
couple
that?
times.
It really has. I mean, I think that it's important to notice what LaMarcus has added to his game. So, everybody knows Jordan added one thing to his game every summer, whether it was a turnaround, a 3-point shot, or whatever. So LaMarcus, the one thing he has, or there's two things he's really done, I think, that are interesting. I would say the first offensive move that he's added is where he gets the ball, and it seems to be an adaptation to the fact that people are guarding him from getting it down parallel with the baseline in the low block. But he'll get the bullet, so they'll push him out, they'll ride him out to say the just below the free throw line or whatever, and he'll get the ball there, and he'll pivot to the middle of the court from the left side. And what he'll do is he'll take a dribble, he'll take a step in with his left foot, and then he'll bounce back on his right foot, and he'll keep his left foot kicked out a little bit like that, the Dirk turnaround, and he'll shoot that little elbow jumper. And not only is he very good at it, but it also seems to have helped him, draw fouls, because people aren't used to having that leg there from that spot, and so they end up with body fouls, or they're, he does it so quickly that they end up, slapping on the elbow or what have you. So that's something he definitely added, definitely worked on this summer, which I think is great. The other part of that is I think that he's gotten to the line a lot more because in the first 20 games of the year or so, he was definitely going to his classic fadeaway on the baseline, left baseline, and it was working obviously. But games say 20 to 35, I really saw teams gamble and jump immediately as he was on the left baseline. As soon as he moved his right shoulder backwards towards the baseline, they just jumped straight backwards and tried to contest his shot. And they were doing a pretty good job, to be honest. So I think that what he's done is he's countered that by he really does go inside the lane a lot. I mean, you'll notice that he'll take two or three dribbles and back guys down in the lane, which is not something he did when he was a second, third year player. I
No,
mean, he
not
wasn't
really.
strong enough to do that. He didn't, right? So and what that's doing is that really, he really is getting he's at that level where he's an all-star, and he's getting foul calls at the rim, to be honest. So it's great to see that. How that's really worked lately with teams is they know that he's going to get the ball down there, and they're fronting him. They're not fronting him full front because they're playing with players that are obviously, it's not a mismatch situation. It's Blake Griffin or something. So they're wrapped around his left leg, but they're in front of him. So what they're doing is they're riding him out with their right hand. They're pushing him out on the hip, and they're making sure that he has to play them at the free throw line. And what that really does is it ends up with a lot more jumpers than it does with shots at the basket, shots at the rim, shots at the block. So I think that's sort of led to the fact that he's not really getting that many free throw attempts.
So defenses have kind of noticed the success that he was able to have earlier on in the season, and they just kind of prevent him from getting the ball in his favorite spots, really is kind of what it boils down to.
Yeah, I think so. And a part of that has also had to do with the caliber of people he's playing against. I mean, look at who he's playing against in the Western Conference. I mean, he has, DeAndre Jordan guarded him the other night, Blake Griffin, Kevin Love, Boogie
Perkins.
Cousins, I mean, Perkins. I mean, lots of guys who are very good on that end of the floor, whether you like to think they are or not. They are. they're very good defenders. So I think they're not necessarily gonna fall for one trick. He needs to have a lot of tricks to him. The good thing for the Blazers is they take away his free throw attempts. Hopefully he gets to have a lot more shots that are open at the top of the arc on the pick and roll or something like that. You can't guard everything. So it's good to see him have that diversity to his game.
Yeah, so the Blazers, when LaMarcus Aldridge is on the floor, that he's certainly the focal point of the offense. But when he's not on the floor, it's kind of hard to see who the go-to person is, depending on who's in the game. And I think what it kind of boils down to is that there really is no, particularly reliable person off the bench. And especially with that Joel Freeland injury happening, I think that we kind of have to talk about maybe bolstering the Blazers bench unit a little bit before the season ends, especially, that might have not been the plan going into the season to get ready for a playoff run. But when you're 19 games over 500, and I think they're the number three spot in the West at the moment, maybe a half game up on that, they're going into the playoffs and they're likely to get a high seed. And so I think that the priorities have shifted to where Neil O'Shea probably is going to be looking
They're
to
five.
their five right now.
Yeah.
So I think, do you think that O'Shea is going to kind of say, you know what, guys, this season was just kind of a transition year. We were trying to just make the playoffs and keep the roster the way it is? Or do you think he should give it a shot and try to bolster that bench just a little bit so that maybe the Blazers can make a little bit of a stronger push in the playoffs.
Well, I think there's two parts to that, and the first one is that, the needs of the Blazers have not changed. It's that the first thing they needed is a wing scorer, a wing cutter. I think they kind of got that in CJ McCollum. He may not be the best defensive presence, obviously, but I think he sort of fills the role or what may carry them through the playoffs. So that's kind of a that's a great boost, considering, they sort of need two things. The other thing they need is they need another defensive bench unit in the post. And if you can kind of take care of one of those things with CJ McCollum, that's great. So I don't necessarily think that Joel Freeland's injury is going to heavily change what they needed. It maybe sort of confirms what they needed, right? Because we knew they needed those two things anyways. We already have, and then have the addition of McCollum come back from injury, and now that Joel Freeland is injured, and we saw, what the early in the season when Freeland went out with that back injury, and we had to have Leonard play against Dwight Howard. I mean, if yeah, I mean that's a legitimate concern. I mean that's an actual playoff match that can happen. That would be a disaster for, I don't know, 11 minutes a game or 15 minutes a game. So the problem with that is that there's not a lot of guys to trade for. I think that's a really difficult position to get at this point in time in the game because, potential suitors for the Blazers are going to be hard to find because A, they don't have a lot of value in draft picks. They don't have draft picks for this year. They have draft picks for next year and after that. So, which, even if you gave up a first round for the next year, that's a little bit less value and it's going to, change who you get back for. The other part of that is with Robinson and Leonard being their two biggest trade pieces, along with Barton, to be honest, if you're not going to trade McCollum, that's really changes who you need back because those are rotation players or potential rotation players with Freeland out or what have you. So if that changes, or sorry, if you make a change there, you're really going to have to get somebody back who you know can play minutes. And if you trade two of them, you're going to have two players back. Maybe one is better than the other, obviously, because you're going to upgrade. But the other one's going to have to be able to, if he's that ninth guy, he's going to have to be able to be that ninth guy and not be like, oh God, we have to play eight guys, So, and that's a problem. A guy I really liked at the beginning of the year, which I still couldn't figure out how to pry him away from New Orleans, was Jason Smith. He's out for the season. There's lots of guys that, if you look around the league, the Blazers' main trade suitors at this point in time aren't going to be contenders, because why would contenders want Myers Leonard and Thomas Robinson, right? They're going to be players. What you're looking for is a veteran presence who has a high salary or a mid-level salary from on a who's on a bad team who is rebuilding. And the problem with that is the Blazers have only prospects to give back to them. They don't have any draft picks, which makes it harder. So, who can they get back from players? We've heard all about Spencer Hawes, which would be a disaster. Most because Spencer Hawes is Spencer Hawes.
His
He also
defense
has
specifically, or
no, the fact that he's Spencer Hawes. I mean, no, I'm just messing around. But
gotcha.
I mean, I that would be hard. I think to they're gonna Philadelphia is gonna get a lot of offers for him. I would anticipate he is moved. Because his salary is it's not that big, so it's easy to move, and he is a valuable player that a real contender could get something back for. But so I think they're gonna get a better offer for him than the Blazers can give them. The other part of that is so if you don't have him, people have talked about Ashik or Ashik, whatever. I don't know if that's gonna happen.
How are we
That's
gonna,
I
they
mean,
don't
I
want
don't know if he
Thomas
moves. I
Robinson
don't think he
back.
moves at all. They don't want Thomas Robinson back, so what are you gonna do? They're not gonna. I don't think they're gonna move him either. There's no reason to go through the playoffs without him. So, what the Blazers do, I'm not really sure at this point in time. They can't sign anybody else. They don't have the cap space to be able to do that. I don't think they
Or the
have,
roster spot.
or the rot. Well, I mean, Victor could get cut. So,
But he's guaranteed for
or
two more
Barton could.
years, right?
Yeah, I mean that's the problem, is that all of these moves have these caveats that are sort of, big ones as far as the either the long-term picture goes, or development picture goes, or draft, picture goes, things like that. So they have all these caveats. It makes it really hard to see a move. But the flip side of that is, people put, say, these trades up on Twitter and people freak out about them, through the ESPN trade machine, and say, oh, there's no reason they would ever do that. And then you see a real trade, and somebody could have put that trade up 3 days ago and it would have got shot down by every basketball writer I know, but it still happened because NBA GMs take gambles in these situations. And that's what they do. They're trying to, especially if you're a contender, you're trying to make sure you have that gamble to push yourself over the edge. So if you think you can, with, you're giving up maybe too much for this one player and you're giving up two guys that are kind of good, or whatever it may be, maybe you take that gamble. So Neil O'Shea is a wheeler dealer. He's obviously going to win, GM of the year, unless the Blazers, I don't know, get swept in the first round or something. He's going to win GM of the year this year. So that's obviously the case. And I think he's going to make a move, to be honest. I don't think that's, lots of times the Blazers have sat pat, and I don't think that's going to be the case this year.
So I think in the past we've noticed that a lot of times it's just kind of come out of nowhere. It's not the trade that you expect. And I think it's what you were saying is they're taking a gamble, and you can only take back what other general managers are willing to give you. And so a lot of times it's not going to be the guy that reporters are talking about being floated out there in trades constantly. That apparently that doesn't seem to happen very often, the guy that they've been talking about trading all the time. So I think that a trade could come, but if it does, it's going to be something probably out of left field that we didn't really anticipate, or something that we didn't put through the ESPN trade machine a bunch of times and really expect to work out.
Do you have an idea for a trade? Do you have somebody you think they might target?
To be completely honest, if I look at the numbers, if I look at the salary cap situation, if I look at what we just discussed, there's no one off the top of my head that really, really jumps out. And if somebody does, say a Brandon Bass, like Sam floated out a couple of weeks ago, just throwing a name out there on the podcast, and he makes 6.5 this year and 6.9 next year, the Blazers just don't have the salary to ship out and match
You're
salary
shipping out
wise.
every single prospect you have. You're empty. You're emptying the end of the bench, which is not what the Blazers are going to do.
So if there is a realistic guy that fits what the Blazers need, there seems to always be some kind of a hang up where the Blazers can't match the salary, or the Blazers can't absorb a larger contract, or they don't have an extra roster spot, or this or that. Without having a trade, or sorry, a draft to trade, a draft pick to trade, that makes things even more unflexible. So, personally, I'd be surprised to see anything that crazy, to be
I
completely
think it's going to
honest.
be, if he grabs somebody, if O'Shea grabs somebody, it's going to be the same thing as Robin Lopez, where, when that happened on draft day, people were, I mean, they weren't necessarily excited about Jeff Withey or anything, but lots of people watched Jeff Withey in the NCAA tournament and were like, oh man, that guy can, shoot and like work around. He's not the, he's already NBA size. They're like, and nobody was expecting this year to happen the way it did. So they were thinking, oh, it's a great piece to like move forward. And they hate Myers Leonard, and there he can take his minutes and all these other things. And when they got Robin, they were thinking, oh, I don't know about this. But if you look at Robin Lopez's per 36 numbers, he's exactly like last year in New Orleans. That's exactly what he putting up this year as an actual starter.
Yeah,
So
playing
not only,
almost 36
not,
minutes.
exactly. No, so not only is he putting them up on average of 36 minutes, but he's putting them up per game of 36 minutes, which is great, because the difference between, people don't realize between those two statistics is, with, as a real life human being, your 36 minutes come in different bursts, which, as a as an athlete, how that affects your production can definitely change. So you can see guys dip when they become a starter in per 36 production because they get tired, or they're playing with different people, or what have you,
Yeah, well, they're
right?
not playing
So
against
it's
second unit guys either.
they're not playing this exactly. Good point. That's a great point. So to see that really be sustained, that's a great move. I think that's, if he grabs somebody, that's who it's going to be. It's going to be somebody who makes, $2.5, $3 million a year. He's going to swap them for two other guys. They're going to accept a little more, cap when they go back. And they're going to grab somebody who people are going to say, that guy's, ninth on some, middling team's bench. Why would we want that him? And then they're going to give him 15 minutes a game, and maybe he's pretty good. Or maybe he's just there to make sure that if Joel Freeland gets in foul trouble, we have somebody else, So, yeah, we'll see. It'll be interesting. We're pretty close to it. We're only a couple days away, and it's always fun to get to the trade deadline.
Yeah, you bet. With I think it's on Thursday, so with that coming up, I guess we can go ahead and wrap this up. But I want to let you know that I really appreciate you coming on to the podcast here. And again, I want to reiterate how awesome it's been for you to be breaking things down for Blazers Edge and kind of put things out there that a lot of casual fans wouldn't otherwise see.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And it's been great to be on Blazers Edge and a part of that community. And the city of Portland really is a basketball town, not just because of the Blazers, but for lots of other reasons. So it's great to be able to interact with them and provide something they haven't had before.
If you'd like to see more from Dane Carbaugh, you can check out his website at youngsabonis.com. He also contributes video playbook breakdowns for BlazersEdge.com, and you can follow him on Twitter. His handle is @DaneCarbaugh. Thank you for listening to this week's edition of the Blazers Edge podcast.